the formula under 60% occupancy is we take our pro forma NOI, we divide it by the market cap. So you would divide it by your pro forma NOI, and that will give you your, you know, your ARV, and then we'll make an offer on 70% of that minus repairs. And that's basically our max allowable offer.
Welcome to the Multifamily Cashflow Addicts Podcast, where you'll learn all the strategies to build passive income one door at a time through multifamily real estate investing. You'll hear from experts in their respected fields and from your real estate investing hosts, Marco and Dan, who have successfully completed dozens of fix and flips and apartment deals. And now, your hosts, Marco Canonico and Daniele DiCerbo.
Hey guys, welcome to the Multifamily Cashflow Addicts Podcast. I'm your co-host Dan.
And I'm your co-host Marco.
And today's an exciting episode for us. It's episode 4, and we're going to be talking about the 6 key factors that we use to analyze a deal in under 10 minutes. So, pretty cool. We're just going to, you know, highlight a lot of the factors that we use, you know, to kind of dive in and show us how when a deal is, you know, sent to us from, you know, whatever deal source that might be, whether it's a, you know, a wholesaler, a broker, or you know, a direct connection that we have with the seller somehow, how we analyze that deal very fast and get back to that you know, that deal source with feedback.
Yeah, and I also want to mention, even though we analyze these deals in as quickly as 10 minutes, sometimes you'll be able to rule out the deal much quicker than that. So it might be, you know, 1 minute or 2 minutes into your preliminary due diligence and you realize this deal is just not going to work. So we say 10 minutes and then, you know, you'll be diving in deeper and deeper once you get it under contract and all that stuff. But this is just like on the surface, like, what am I looking at? How you can figure, like, this is something I want to give my time to, or this is something that I need to just move on from and keep moving.
Exactly. And, you know, providing feedback, you know, to the broker, for example, like we deal a lot with brokers. We obviously deal with, you know, wholesalers and directly with sellers and all that, but you know, our main deal source is brokers, and you know, to kind of build that relationship, you need to be able to provide that feedback as soon as you can. So you need to have, you know, the proper spreadsheets to analyze data as fast as you can. You know, analyze markets. We went over that, you know, last week, talking a little bit about you know, how to analyze markets. So hopefully, you know, these deals that are being sent to you, you know, are in your core submarket. So you understand if the market can support your deal, but you know, keep in mind, you do need to be quick. One of the main reasons is because the market is super tight right now. And if you do find a, you know, a solid deal with, you know, great returns and strong cash flow, or, you know, you see the value add opportunity, like, you need to be able to strike fast and get feedback back as soon as you can, because, you know, it's going to be a dogfight.
Dan, when's it ever not competitive out there?
Well, I mean, right now the market's at a high, and it's very hard to find those.
What's important, though, about what you said is when it's a deal, when it is genuinely a deal, it's not going to just sit there.
For sure. And deals are far and few right now in, you know, the climate of the market, right?
So for sure.
At any time, this is the most, you know, the quickest you have to be, right?
Absolutely. You also made a really good point there when you talked about relationships with these brokers. They are a key source of the deal flow that exists in the marketplace, in any market. Obviously, wholesalers have a big presence there with having deals, and sometimes other investors have them, or directly, you know, the seller won't even talk to anybody about it and they're reaching directly to investors, which does happen as well. So but brokers do have the majority, I would say, of the deals that exist, and having a good relationship with them is super important, because without that, you know, they don't even want to work with you, and it's a very small world out there. So when you burn the bridge with somebody, it doesn't take long for word to get around that you're a flaky buyer, or you just don't have the qualifications to pull the trigger. And at the end of the day, you have to understand what the incentives are of everybody. And if you're a real estate agent, you're a commercial real estate broker, your job is to filter people out right away. Because if you invest a lot of time and effort working with a buyer that just can't close, that's wasted effort. It could be wasted money. And as a broker, you know, you get those big paydays only when deals close. Yeah. So if you're working with someone who can't close, you're working for free, they don't want to waste their time. I'm actually going to share a quick story here. I was actually working with a commercial broker. This was in the Ohio, this was in Cleveland, Ohio area. Yeah. And I was working with a broker, and he actually, like, it was pretty funny, actually. It was a minute or two into the call. I just let him know I was looking for some deals, and He just started bombarding me with questions. And at the time, I didn't really know that this wasn't normal. Not that it doesn't happen. I mean, brokers definitely ask their fair share of questions, but the questions just came in like, you know, who are you working with? Do you have... Basically, he's asking me if I had money. He was qualifying me as a buyer.
Right.
And, you know, I think as everybody can probably tell, we didn't have a very long-lasting relationship. And, you know, if I ever came across that guy again to work with him, he's probably going to be like, it's this guy again, you know, who doesn't know how to answer any of my questions, who isn't a real buyer.
You got shadow banned.
Exactly. Yeah. So you got to be very careful with the brokers that you're talking to. Just to be armed. The best thing I find is just to come in and let them know I'm working with a pool of investors. We're expanding into a new market. Bang, bang, bang. This is what we're looking for. And just having that investor talk by letting them know the cap rates you're looking for. Value add is a term that's just tossed around by investors. So just by using the lingo and letting them know that, hey, I have a team. I'm working with high net worth individuals and we're moving into a new territory. Something as simple as that lets them know this is a real buyer. They have deals. They're expanding into my market. Whether this is true or not, they will take you much more seriously and they won't even bombard you with questions, I find, because you're just throwing all the marbles on the table that, hey, look, I know what I'm talking about. Let's get some deals. And they love that. So that's something that's happened over the evolution of my real estate career and Dan, your real estate career as well. Like, we've really learned that tactic, which is awesome. But, you know, I think we should just jump right in here to talk about, you know, some of these factors.
Yeah, so basically just six main factors that we use. And, you know, within each factor, we'll kind of dive in deep. To the micro level of like the actual financial analysis and all that, but there's a lot of kind of preliminary stuff that we'll cover within each factor. But Marco, you wanna?
Yeah, I'll get started here. Yeah. So you know, the whole concept of just understanding that deals aren't always around in your face, okay? And I would say it's probably about 100 to maybe 150 deals that we actually look at. And we won't take the full 10 minutes for each one. Some of them, like I said, we're ruling them out in 30 seconds and we're on to the next one. Some of them, you know, we dive in a little bit deeper. Numbers look good. Things look good. We go a little further and then we figure something out and we don't want that deal because it's located next to a cemetery or something crazy. And that all makes sense why it's being sold at the price that it is. And we'll move on from that deal. And that might be 5 minutes into our preliminary due diligence. So, you know, we're looking through, we're sifting through tons and tons of deals before we find one. And I also want to actually make another point here. Good deals are not always found. They're usually actually created. And this is through, you know, how you structure the deal. Because the purchase price and the income can be very irrelevant with outstanding negotiation skills. If you can just make everybody happy and you've got a very minimal amount of cash in and your cash out is just, you know, your return on investment essentially is what I'm getting at here. If those numbers work, you can actually create a deal. It's not about finding them, it's about creating them. So that's another important element. But generally speaking, we're looking at 100 to 150 deals before we actually find something that is worth writing an offer, locking up, and then taking the real steps to find out what's actually going on in that property.
Yeah, and just to add to that, right, like the sentiment that kind of comes over a lot of us buyers is, you know, this FOMO, this the fear of missing out. So by approaching it in a more, you know, conscious approach of, you know, you need to evaluate a certain amount of deals before you find that one, it kind of allows you to step back and not feel like, you know, this deal's got to be the one. I got to find a way to make it work. And then you put yourself in a bad situation, you get tied up in a property that you end up losing money. You know, so you're always better to be on, you know, on the outside if you're not stuck in a bad deal. So just don't feel the pressure when a deal comes across your desk. Be conscious and you know that there'll be a next deal.
Yeah, and I also want to make a point that when you're starting out, you're going to not have access to the real quality deals because having the integration into the real estate community allows you to see deals before they get to another level. So, you know, before it hits the market is one of the biggest, you know, ways of hearing about quality deals before it gets into the eyes of everybody else, or I should say the hands of, you know, your everyday investor. You want, like, And when I mean everyday investor, I don't actually mean everyday investor. I mean like everyday person. I mean somebody who's just, you know, I got a little extra cash. Maybe I'm a doctor, lawyer. I want to buy some real estate. They talk to one broker and say, what do you have? That's what I'm talking about. You're going to see like the leftovers that everybody already saw. The real quality investors are right in there with the wholesalers, the brokers. And the second a good deal comes up, if you have a good connection with them, they will send it to you first. So you've got the first eyes on it. And that's something that we actually have, which is really, really, really good and really helpful for us to see deals that most people don't see.
Yeah, you get those pocket listings.
Absolutely. Right, and then and with our, you know, our evolution, we've got a team really of wholesalers and brokers that are sending us deals, other investors that are sending us deals. I've actually had deals sent to me through Instagram. Actually, by the way, if anybody you know, hasn't followed me already, follow me on Instagram. It's Marco Canonaco, just first and last name, MarcoCanonaco. You can send me a direct message. I'm very responsive on Instagram. I post a lot of real estate related content, so definitely check it out. But yeah, people on Instagram will message me and say, hey, I've got an awesome deal. Do you invest in you know, the Florida market? Do you invest in this market, et cetera? And we'll look at those deals, and you know, they're not always good, but it's just another avenue for people to bring stuff to us. So as you grow your real estate presence and people know what you're doing, you'll start to have people reach out and send you deals as well, which is really awesome.
So, I mean, the next factor is strong local rental growth. So this is a topic that we kind of focused heavily on last episode, right? So last episode, we dove into, you know, how and why we select markets. Obviously, today we're looking at how we select deals, specifically under 10 minutes. We deep dive into the deal submarket to understand those rent trends. So this has to do a lot with, like, can the, you know, the deal submarket, can it support, you know, the property that we're looking to acquire? You know, can rent be raised, you know, at a decent, you know, escalation on an annual basis? So just looking for that, you know, the economic drivers, understanding, you know, what makes a city tick. You know, what's the demographic of the people living in it? You know, what's the makeup of occupation? You know, these sort of things that kind of drive that little, you know, area's economy. So once you understand that and have a good picture of that, that kind of gives you a good idea of if your deal's going to work. Obviously, the numbers have to make sense, and we'll go into that in number 4 and 5 of our key factors here. But again, understanding that submarket is going to give you a good idea. You can obviously, we gave some resources on the last episode where you can kind of check out and understand and dive more into these markets. But, you know, just doing some preliminary research on your markets before you analyze your deal, you'll have a good idea and you should be set.
All right. And the next one here is value add and upside potential. So this is probably one of the biggest things we're looking at when we're analyzing these deals. So look at the numbers. Can we increase the net operating income? Can it happen? And the most obvious and simple way to do this is to increase the rent. So you got to ask yourself, and we do this when we're looking at the deals, is there room to bring the rent up? And you have to look at the comparables when you're doing this. You have to look at what amenities do these buildings have? What do the finishes look like inside the building? How much square footage are the other, you know, are these other buildings offering for tenants that want to live there? Can we match it? Can we be comparable? And if we can, then yes, there's an opportunity to bring up the rent. So that's a huge thing that we're looking at. Now they could be below market simply because the landlord didn't bump them, just didn't feel like it was something he wanted to do. Sometimes landlords are just happy to collect rent, period. They've got a long-term tenant. They say, you know what? He's paying. I'm not even going to care. But they don't really realize where the market rent has actually moved to. Right. So they're sitting at $500 thinking, yeah, I might be able to get 50, 100 more, but I'd rather just keep paying. I'd rather that unit just pay me every single month. I don't want it to turn over to a sloppy tenant, to a trouble tenant. This guy's good. We're going to leave him. But you know, the rent's up to $700-$800 and you're still collecting $500. You no wonder he's still staying there. You know, so that's something that we're looking at for sure. Another reason why the rents could be low is because the actual unit quality. So is there some sort of renovation we need to pump into it? Now that's another thing. If we could put maybe $5,000 into a unit to do some paint, carpet, and some other minor upgrades, can we collect another $200? Which on an annual basis comes out to $2,400, and every dollar is roughly $10 of value. And right there, that's 24 grand. So that would be a good investment if we were to do something like that. So that's the kind of stuff we're looking for. Is there room there to create value? And then there's also things like adding extra income, which has nothing to do with the rents. So adding a laundromat or paid amenities of some kind on the property. I know there's people that even they'll find like a vending machine guy to come in, and for maybe $200, he leaves his machine there. So things like that will definitely help to bring extra income. You can even do advertisements like billboards on the property.
The towers on the
satellite dishes.
Telecom companies, right?
Things like that. And then the last way would be to lean out some expenses. This is a little bit tougher to catch when you're just kind of in your preliminary due diligence. But, you know, if you do have an opportunity to find a new maintenance contractor to take on a lower price, or even if there's something that's just being paid for that doesn't need to be there, that'll help drive the NOI up, which will raise value.
And so the fourth factor that we have here is verifying actuals and not performance. So for those who don't are not familiar with the performance, basically a projected course of action for the property, right? So typically a lot of brokers, when they share you know, offering memorandums with potential you know, buyers for their properties that they're listing, or even wholesalers that are marketing their, you know, properties that they have under contract to prospective investors, they're creating potential rent increases, you know, based off of, if you were to put X amount of improvements into the building, can raise rents by, you know, X amount. For example, maybe today that property's actuals are maybe $700 a unit they're collecting, but it's being marketed on a pro forma basis as, you know, $900 a unit or $1,000 a unit once you put, you know, $500,000 into that property. So pro formas, you know, things can get tricky because it's obviously sometimes there's, you know, sometimes it's opinion-based and it's biased. Obviously, if someone who's marketing that property, they want to make it look more attractive to a buyer, so you have to be careful with performance. You have to, you know, go out and do your research. Again, there's some sites that we listed on the last episode that you can go out and actually verify, you know, rental comps to see what all the properties, and, you know, in a 5-10 mile radius from, you know, the subject property, what kind of rent they're fetching for very similar unit mixes. So you got to go out and verify and do your own due diligence on, you know, what those typical units will rent. And there's also other variables that affect, you know, what kind of rent you can fetch, like extra amenities than what maybe your property has, where it's located, when it was built. So there's a lot of variables. So the point of this factor is that we want to make our offer on actuals, so today's numbers, and not performas. We want to keep the performas and kind of outline where we think we can drive this property in terms of, you know, adding value, but we want to make we want to verify and base our analysis on actuals. A key important term when you're verifying, you know, these rent rolls and in these financial statements, these, you know, trailing, typically you get the trailing 12 months, you know, from the current owner, you're going to want to find the economic vacancy. So the economic vacancy is basically the actual, you know, occupancy. So for example, let's say that you have, you know, a building that's, there's 100 units and there's a physical occupancy of 90 tenants. So 90 out of 100 units are being rented out physically by 90 people. But if you look at the financial statements, you'll see that, you know, there's a certain amount of funds that haven't been collected from several tenants. So you're trying to find the true economic occupancy or economic vacancy of the property. Just because there's physically 90 people in that 100 unit building, that doesn't mean that you have, you know, I mean, you don't want to base your numbers on that, because several, you know, let's say, for example, 3 out of those 90 haven't made payments in the last 2 or 3 months, that, you know, that money is due. So just because they're physically there, you're not making any money off of them. So you actually have a, you know, an economic occupancy of like maybe 85%, or, you know, an economic vacancy of 13% as opposed to 8%, right? So the numbers can kind of move around when you're looking at actuals. So just keep in mind that, you know, those are super important when you're making, you know, when you're analyzing your deal. You want to look at actuals and not get too drawn into the pro forma numbers, and because sometimes if you can't achieve those pro forma numbers, then the deal just doesn't work, and, you know, you're going to default and you lose the property, right?
Yeah, and just like you mentioned, how many times have we seen all these crazy pro formas oh, this building is going to make all... Like, if I sell these performers, I think to myself, why is this guy selling it then?
Yeah, it's
too like, it just right? makes no sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely something to take note of there, and definitely do your homework. Okay, so the next one we have here is stabilized assets. If the cap... So, what we're looking at here is we want to focus on high cap rate deals. So, is the cap rate high enough? Why is it high? And then we're also looking at, like, we want to do value add deals. So we're looking at deals where once we finish with it, we're cash flowing very, very well off of the investment that we put in. And we will sometimes take on deals that are like, you know, 90 plus occupancy. But I do want to mention to anybody, if you are interested at all in learning more about how you can passively invest in one of our upcoming deals, simply just text apartments to 813-213-0427 if you live in the United States. Now, if you live in Canada, text apartments to 647-691-1043.
Yeah, so basically just text those numbers, guys, and you'll get some cool resources. There's some PDF explaining kind of how everything works and some other resources. So shoot a text and yeah.
Yeah, so let me get back to these high cap rate deals and this value add stuff that we're looking at. So essentially, we want to know that we can make money on these deals by doing some kind of crazy value add. That's what we're interested in. That's what I think most investors are interested in that are working the way we are. How can I make a tremendous amount of wealth in a short period of time? And that's through raising value by creating income from a building that's just stuck. And it's stuck because it needs usually renovations or something like that. So we're focused on that kind of stuff, and that's what we're looking for. But sometimes we do come across these 90 plus occupancy deals. They're cash flowing nicely. We're always going to try to create as much value as we can. So we'll buy those even though there isn't a whole lot of room for increase in value. But that's just because already the numbers look good. And we're always going to try to maximize the income, lean out the expenses every single time. So there's going to be some value increase when we're done with the property every time. But we're looking for like the huge profits, which come from completely vacant buildings. They come from really like completely vacant buildings are like the easiest targets out there. So that's a good sign that there's money to be made. But then this goes back into what we talked about earlier on in the podcast, which is your ability to negotiate, because you have to know as a buyer when you're looking at this building, the only person that's ever going to purchase it is an investor. Somebody's going to buy this building and they're going to make money off of it. So if I'm going to buy to make money on it, and I'm going to jump into your problem, because it's a problem, because if it's not making money, it's definitely losing money. That's for sure. So if I'm going to jump into the problem, how am I going to ensure that I'm going to make money on it? And the only way is to, you know, slate the deal so the numbers work in your favor. You can incorporate seller financing, which we've talked about in other podcasts. You can incorporate various strategies. You can actually bring the seller in as a partner. There's so many ways to string it all together, but you have to negotiate a good deal. So that's a good sign that you're in a distressed situation. Seller is willing to talk. And then at that point, you know, you got to make the deal work. And that's what we're focused on. So if you see that opportunity, you're definitely looking at something where there's potential. But it's about how do you string it together? How do you wrap up all the pieces? How do you create a win-win between your lenders, your money partners, your the seller, you? Like, everybody's got to come out of there with money. So that's the focus. So when we see that stuff, we're definitely going to be analyzing the deals, but the numbers have to work.
Yeah, and just to add to that too, like, just a kind of rule of thumb that, you know, we use when we're looking at deals in terms of like caps. Like, we want to see at least like a 2-point spread from, you know, the cap rate on the deal and the cost is going to service the debt. So for example, like, if the cost of like the first mortgage to acquire the property is a, you know, a 5% rate, and, you know, the cap rate is at least a 7, then that tells us at least that there's enough room in the deal. And obviously we have to further vet it and see if everything else works, but that will kind of tell us at least that there's enough room in terms of you know, your debt stack and you know, how much cash is being produced.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the last factor we have is, do the numbers work? Right. So, you know, after all the aforementioned that Marco and I just spoke about, By the way, I have a huge problem with the and I always say myself before I mention the second person name, but I'm improving that. But yeah, so you know, after all the aforementioned, you know, we come up with the maximum allowable offer. So the MAO, which is the maximum amount we can pay to acquire the deal. The maximum offer works off of the deal still having enough room to weather market conditions and still pay a healthy return, you know, to yourself or investors of, in the likes of, you know, what we have going on here, right? So you need to know what cash is going to be required in this deal in terms of improvements. You know, there's it's not just the difference between, you know, what the loan amount is going to be is and what you need to close. There's obviously other miscellaneous expenses. You know, there's lawyer fees. There's several different inspection fees, appraisals. You know, there's other fees that are structured into deals as well, too. So there's you need to know exactly what your cash is or have at least, you know, a good idea of what that's going to be. Obviously, like what Marco was mentioning, you know, earlier in one of those factors, when you're getting into further due diligence, you'll understand a little bit more and have a better idea of you know, what kind of cash is required to get it done. But if you can have a decent ballpark of by just looking at the preliminary information that was sent to you and maybe a packet or you doing your own little due diligence yourself online, understanding what your cash is going to, you know, what's required in terms of cash in is going to help you identify, you know, what the potential returns are for the deal. So we basically plug in all these numbers into our spreadsheets and it tells us exactly what kind of, you know, month-to-month kind of returns we're going to be getting on our cash. So we plug these numbers in and we basically reverse engineering the deal by that. Also, it's important to know your break-even occupancy. Like if occupancy comes down to 70% or 65%, like can we still break even, be able to service debt, and you know, basically not lose the property, right? So you need to know all these numbers, these bottom line numbers. But we look at deals like two different ways, right? So there's obviously properties that are in, you know, high distress, right? And then there's properties that are a little bit more stable. The previous owner kind of wants to sell the property and move on to the next project or, you know, jump on a sail ship and travel the world. So, I mean, you never know these situations, but my point is there's two different types of properties. And sometimes when you deal with the, you know, the high distress property, there could be 100% vacancy, right? So it's how do you make an offer on a property like that? So we look at these two types of deals, you know, differently. Obviously, we want to try to be as accurate as we can to actual numbers like we spoke about earlier with economic, you know, occupancies and vacancies and all that. But typically, if the property is below like 60% occupancy, then we'll basically use like a, you know, pro forma numbers if a broker or like a wholesaler provide us with them. And that will be suitable to kind of, I know we kind of just trashed pro formas, or not really trash them, but just to be, you know, be wary of them.
Be careful, for sure.
Yeah, right. So, but in this scenario, when it's such a low occupancy, you don't really have much to go off of, and you're going to buy for, you know, severely undervalued, right? It's maybe 60, 70 cents on the dollar, maybe lower, depending on the situation. Then you can include, you know, pro forma numbers. So what we do is the formula under 60% occupancy is we take our pro forma NOI, we divide it by the market cap. So in due diligence, if we've already vetted the area, we'll know typically like what that market cap is. Or if it's a new broker that you're working with, you know, shoot them over an email, you know, ask them what a typical market cap is in that that submarket.
For that type of property.
Yeah, for that type of property, exactly. So you would divide it by your pro forma NOI, and that will give you your, you know, your ARV. And then we'll make an offer on 70% of that minus repairs. And that's basically our max allowable offer. So this is in a scenario that's a property that's like somewhat pretty distressed, right? And then we'll want to, you know,
and we'll even go lower than that.
Yeah,
I think you were just actually about to mention that.
Yeah, like we'll basically start off like 10% below our strike price. Our strike price being like where we want to, you know.
But I mean, if the building is a very high risk deal and there's a lot of problems going on, and we don't feel we're actually as, you know, we can't pinpoint that ARV as well, we might just go a lot lower because we want to just keep ourselves safe. And if we can't do that, other investors probably can't do that. So, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying. Who's going to buy this building if it's not an investor? It's going to be an investor, and it's going to be somebody pumping in a lot of cash to get it to where it needs to be. And when you know that as a buyer, you got more bargaining power with the seller. Because if he wants to play hardball and doesn't want to come down in price and has all these crazy terms, all you got to do is walk. Because if it's really you know, a tough purchase, then he'll figure it out with time. The market will tell him, and he's going to be forced to work with people. So, and that's the thing you got to understand. When you're doing residential real estate, whether it's single family homes, condos, townhouses, any sort of investment in that regard, you're dealing with investor to seller, or I meant investor to Mr. and Mrs. homeowner, you know, and if you're not an investor, if you're just buying for your own personal use, then that's homeowner to homeowner, nothing going on there. But as investors, when you're fixing and flipping houses, you're talking to the homeowner, most likely, who is Mr. and Mrs. seller, who just lived there happily, and they don't really know a whole lot about real estate, and they're not, you know, it's probably a big deal for them. They probably only had a handful of transactions that they've seen in their life. They probably just bought that home. This might only be the second transaction that they'll ever have to go through in that moment, at that point. That's the second one that they're, maybe they're going to go buy a third, who knows. But my point is, when you're talking multifamily, this is investor to investor. They were you when you bought it. So they're looking at you like, you know, in a different lens. They're a little bit more sophisticated than your average homeowner. And because of that, you also have to understand, this guy is an investor. Why is he not renovating this building and keeping it himself? Why is it being sold? So these are a lot of questions that we like to answer through what we just explained in our analyzing.
Yeah, and just to finish that off, so the latter of that, if it's a high occupancy property and it's more stabilized, then we obviously base our numbers on, you know, legitimate actual economic vacancies and, you know, occupancies and all that. So true rents, true actuals, and then we, you know, we'll see what they're asking for it, and then see if the numbers work based off of our cash in and what return we can get in our cash. And that's basically something.
Yeah, essentially, like, yeah, when it's below a certain point, we're just seeing what the building's capable of producing.
Yeah,
exactly. But yeah, this is all good information for anybody listening. Thanks everyone who's been listening to our podcasts. We've got a lot of good stuff coming up. Next podcast, Dan, what's the topic? Market appreciation and...
market appreciation versus...
Versus forced appreciation. Yeah. One of my favorite topics. Yeah, I'm actually really excited, yeah, for this one. Next week's going to be really, really good.
We touched a lot on market appreciation, right, last week.
Yeah, I think when you went into numbers, that was really good quality stuff there for everybody.
Cycles and all that you're talking about?
No, in this podcast, just now, when you talk about the numbers breaking down, you know, the occupancy and all that stuff is really, really good quality stuff. And when we talk next week about market versus forced appreciation, we're going to get really into numbers and talk about how those differences can...
Yeah, really sway value with those improvements.
Absolutely,
that you add, right? So,
all right, so that wraps everything up. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And we'll see you next time.
See you next week, guys.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the Multifamily Cash Flow Addicts podcast. For more free podcasts, go to anchor.fm/cashflowaddicts. If you're interested in learning more about how you can passively invest into one of Marco and Dan's upcoming multifamily deals, text APARTMENTS to 813-213-0427 if you reside in the U.S. or text APARTMENTS to 647-691-1043 if you reside in Canada. You can also visit willowdaleequity.com to learn more. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.